We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
Hello and welcome to the Mind of Magnus. Our show has a simple premise. We're here to share the stories and life adventures of others to help expand our minds. I'm Matt Austin, and here's your host, Magnus.
Hello there, folks. Welcome again to another edition of the Mind of Magnus. Recording once again from the High Falls up here in Rochester, New York, having a blast. I have a guy with me tonight that I'm super excited for because everyone knows I love sharing factoids. I love expanding the brain. And this man here has helped expand my brain. During the pandemic, I probably put his YouTube channel on and just let it go for days and allowed myself to create art and learn about crazy things, science fiction, futuristic stuff, everything you think of. My guest today is John Michael Gaudier. And he's an author. He's a futurist. He's got one of the best voices for talking science we can find online here. He runs two successful YouTube channels, one bearing his name, that's where I got him from, and his second one, Event Horizon. It's a YouTube series that has been bringing on some of the greatest thinkers I have been honored to learn about from this man. I want to say I'm bringing him on also because there is a lot of stuff going on in the world right now. It's stressful, so I'm bringing a futurist on because I want some sci-fi wonder. I want some expand our brains, and I want to have a great conversation. And the internet had a quote about him, and it was, thanks to this man on Reddit, says, his curiosity makes for a great interview. So that alone made me want to have this man on. So John Michael Gaudier, thank you for joining me on the Mind of Magnus.
Magnus, it's good to be here with you, man. I'm happy we could make this work after, talking for, an email for weeks.
But, back and forth. I appreciate your patience because I was very excited. When you're like, yeah, come on. Because I have a lot of questions. I mean, I just love listening to everything you've done. I've been very impressed by your podcast, but just us talking for the past pre-ramble 10 minutes here, I now have a zillion more questions. But let's start this thing off. You are an author. You're a futurist, which I probably want to have you describe what a futurist really is to the audience in here. But you are a passionate man about science and science education.
I am. And what a futurist is, or which is really the real term is futurologist, but they're known as futurists. And what I do is I try to extrapolate the current state of technology and imagine what that's going to be like in a year, 10 years, 50 years, 1,000 years. And that's, a tradition that goes through a lot of science fiction authors. Martha Clarke was famous for it. But that's what I try to do is try to imagine what our future is going to be like. But that's good for writing stories about the future. So, you're going to find a lot of science fiction authors are do this and think about where are we going to be in 50 years.
I'm generally curious because I need to know the path that kind of got you to where you are, too. You're a little older than I am, but your passion for taking information and sharing it is one of the things that sets you apart from a lot of other shows. Some people, like, you have, like, a top 10 list on one thing, and then on, like, your Event Horizon, you are deep diving with scientists asking very hard-hitting questions on very specific topics. So it seems like you must be an extremely well-read man as well, too, here. But let's see. We have, when you're a little kid, what's the little John like? Is he a science nerd? Is he what's going on?
I can tell you exactly the date, or the year anyway, when this all happened. And it was roughly around 1980. Mm-hmm. And I saw two things as a kid. The first thing that I saw, which my dad was a military contractor, and he was living in Oregon, and I was up there staying with him. And I saw Mount St. Helens explode on May 8th, 1980, and I was like, volcanoes exist. And that started sort of the science part, but also around the same time when Dad was back in Missouri, he took me on a hunting trip. And this was in the middle of the night, but nobody shot anything. It was just spotting raccoons with high-powered lights. And my dad's friend, whose farm it was, had found a rock on the shore of his pond. And he took a chunk off of this rock with a hammer and took it to somebody that knew something of science, a business owner in a nearby town. And they thought it was a meteorite. And then that got me thinking, wait, rocks fall from the sky? And that started the whole thing. I got into geology and fossils and hunted fossils, so I still do today. And that's how that started. So it all started when I was about, 5 years old,
Oh my God, wow.
And it continues to this day. How I learned to communicate it happened in high school, early high school, because I had a telescope and I was obsessed with telescopes, right? My parents had bought me one and then bought me a big one because they're like,
oh, nice.
Yeah, he's serious.
Oh, man. Gold star for the parents.
Yeah, gold star for the parents, because both my parents were very, very science-minded. My dad was an engineer. My mom was a rock hound. So they were buying me books or anything, that helped foster the brain. But anyway, but that's where all of that started was the meteorite, which incidentally is probably still sitting out there on the shore of that lake. So I've found no record of anyone ever recovering that thing.
How big was the rock? In my mind, first I have this little like handheld rock. It's
don't remember, but it seems to have been very large. But again, that was almost 50 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So I don't remember how big, but it seems to me that I recall that it was big.
That's awesome. Oh my God. A giant meteorite. That is like a set from a TV show. That's perfect for the start of your origin story. The script is already writing itself. I'm liking this. This is pretty great.
Well, it was what happened. And about how I got into education. Mm-hmm. That's a weird story in itself. I was dragging a telescope out to school and on the street corners. And I was part of something called, street corner astronomers, basically, where you show the night sky to people. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned how to communicate it, was to talk it up. This is Saturn, and people look through the eyepiece and they see Saturn's rings.
Yeah, yeah.
Obvious, which is blew me away when I was about 10.
When I realized you can see it, like I've seen pictures of it, but like through the optics, I am seeing the rings. I thought like, it's like, that's not real. I fully understand that wonder. That is a core memory in me as well. Like at first I'm like, I'm expecting a little dot, like a star, maybe seeing a little bit of shape, but when I'm looking through there and I can see exactly I can see colors in ring, truly a spark to a little kid. It was crazy.
Yeah, me too. And it bolstered, thing. And that really is what pushed me into astronomy though, was seeing Saturn and seeing that through that little tiny telescope. It's a small, like 30 millimeter thing. This was before the big one that I got in high school for my birthday. And, that sort of solidified it. Mm-hmm. And I literally have not changed since. There has been no personal growth since.
I peaked. I don't need to go any further than that. I already hit the high notes there. That's very well. As for at least for our side of things, you delivering all these amazing videos, like you have one. I'll jump around. This is going to be one of those conversations because I'm very excited to talk with you. I try to write down ideas and have a conversation with you. And every topic, I have a list that's super long. I'm like, you know what? I have faith that whatever's going to happen is going to be a great conversation. So I'm warning all the listeners right now, this may be a convoluted, awesome conversation, but I want to bring up that like you are hustling and sharing stuff, your YouTube channels that you put out, you have, so Event Horizon comes out every Thursday. You do one,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that's your big, big one now. That is because I knew you, I actually didn't realize Event Horizon until later on because I had been following you with just your namesake on YouTube. And that one was where I had a lot more of like 15 minute long episodes or shorter ones, like the top 10 and very specific scientific niche things that you should know about. It has been captivating to see the growth of your YouTube
like how the like the small little things to a much more refined show with guests, and you have some solid polls. I have to say, the scientist you have on here, I was reading a paper on someone and just happened to see on an episode you, I went to do a research for more on it, and you came up on it. I think it was on the consciousness, I think it was one of the ones they were talking about. And the top link was your Event Horizon on consciousness. So it's been amazing. So the child that peaked then, you were still riding that high this entire time from the science nerd's perspective here.
Absolutely. And I just turned it into a career, you know, whether it's writing a science fiction novel, which obviously my novels are hard science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I had a go at YouTube because you got to have some kind of social media presence. And lo and behold, it grew. And I was like, well, talk show, I'll do Event Horizon. And I had the people behind me. I had a producer and, you know, people that I knew from other places. Mm-hmm. And it also grew. But I would not want to be doing anything else in life than what I'm doing. I absolutely love it. And that's what makes it good, is that I really love the topics, or else I won't talk about them. I'd be a terrible sportscaster. But, you know, but I will interview on things that interest me, that I'm engaged with, and will read about and research and prepare properly for the guest, and do my best. People seem to like it. And then I also, you know, think things through on my original channel, you know, sci-fi concepts and how they relate to science, and also just weird, you know, things in science that, you know, may indicate things like aliens, or may indicate things like a new, you know, force of nature, or something quantum mechanical that doesn't make any rational sense in our big world, our big relativistic world, but they're real. Mm-hmm. Those are the things. And then I also will dig into history and sometimes things like film. I interviewed, filmmaker Werner Herzog once.
Oh my God. I had no idea. That's amazing.
up on Event Horizon. And that was one of those times, man, where, you know, they always say, don't meet your heroes, but I did. And he was always my favorite filmmaker. And he was the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. It was fantastic.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, my God. Yeah, I know people say don't meet your heroes, but I mean,
with Werner Herzog off air, mm-hmm. and Werner Herzog on air, it was the same guy that you would, if you know who he is, it's the same guy.
Oh, and, that's good. Yeah. Oh, man. I think that's probably why I like his work so much. There's a genuineness. I think he probably like you, too, for the same reason that you were sincerely the person you are. I feel like Werner Herzog is a guy who's had enough people wearing their PR masks, putting the bullshit on in front of them, that he can see through that. So if he sees a genuineness in it, that's why I think he picks his cast and crew and that stuff to be around, based on there's sincerity about it. And that's what all your work always strikes me as, sincerity. Like,
that's essential. Mm-hmm. Sincerity. Be that, you know, you know, mm-hmm. You can always tell, you know, audiences can always tell that this person is not, you know, this is somebody they hired, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
Audiences are very smart and savvy, and they can instantly tell that. Mm-hmm. But that's why I won't do sports interviews, because I don't know what I was talking about. But
same. One more fact we have. I'm not a sport guy. Like, I'll go to a game with a friend and eat a hot dog and have an event of sorts. But if you have an opportunity to go, like, want to go to sports, you want to go watch this, I'll go to the University of Rochester here in Rochester, and they have an astronomer's talking. Like, Adam Frank's a professor there, and every once in a while he'll give, like, I'm giving a presentation. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go do this. People are like, well, we're going to go. I'm like, no, if they sold a hot dog at Adam Frank's talk, I'd be even better. I think they'd be great. But
yeah, I've talked to Adam Frank a number of times, he's got some wild ideas.
Isn't he? Oh my God. That's Rochester, New York. We are a weird bunch. And I am happy to say that even our scientists are weird. He's from New Jersey, but now he's got the Rochester on him too. So yeah, this is a crazy weird town. Spiritualism started in this town. Like, this is where, like, the Fox sisters. So there's a lot of, like, weird cults started here, but there's a weirdness in this town. And the cool thing is, the weirdness also bleeds into the science nature. There's, like, great, like, you love it here because you're a sci-fi author. There are creative, weird scientists here that are, like, it's remarkable to see. So, but yeah, Adam Frank is one of the ones. So
yeah, Adam Frank's amazing. Mm-hmm. He's definitely one of our really outside of the box thinkers, without going too far.
Yes. And that's the thing. I have to say that is one of the things I've been impressed by you as well, because it is tough to be a creative, like you're a sci-fi author as well. Actually, and one of the questions I'm going to get, I have some questions from you, from guests, from like listeners and stuff, but you're a sci-fi author, and that allows for a level of creativity that you question things about, like just a couple more steps away, like what if, but you're still trying to be in the realm of the cosmos, the true world, without going too fanciful.
I want to know what could be real.
That's a great way of saying it. What could be? Yeah.
The universe allow to be. Oh.
So in your path now, you being 50 years in sci-fi, you have watched the evolution of what could be real getting more and more real and things popping up. Has there been something that, like something that you've known that was going to happen in science? You were there because you kind of read about it and figured out it, and science agrees.
I got a big one, and it's going to spook you.
Oh my God. Yes. That's what I want. Be spooked. Yes. Expand my brain and spook me.
So I wrote a book called Supermind that came out in 2017. And I had thought about artificial intelligence since the 90s. You know, we were working with our 486 computers, you know, and all that. We already knew that eventually artificial intelligence would be a thing.
Because, yeah.
You know, you saw Mr. Data on Star Trek.
Star Trek, yep.
But the thing is that the predictions that were going on in the 90s, 2000s, 2010s were that, okay, it's going to take over some jobs, but it's not going to take over art. Mm-hmm. It went in directions we didn't realize, you know, and there could be a day where we're writing science fiction novels, which that day is already here, frankly. Publishers are having a heck of a time differentiating something that, you know, an author had an AI write, you know, versus something that was actually real. And in 5 years, that's going to be basically seamless. So I called it wrong in my futurism. I predicted that this would not happen for another 30, 40 years.
In 2015.
But what I wrote in there is coming true now, much faster.
Do you feel that your prediction...
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you feel like that it just AI was what your prediction was true? It just happened faster, or the very fundamental understanding of AI is different than what you thought AI could be? You don't understand the question?
The prediction was, you know, basically that the human race would go into a post-scarcity state. In other words, you would transition to where, you know, the economist John Maynard Keynes once wrote that man would solve his economic problem. Meaning that, you know, the machines would do everything for us. And
I was promised.
Yeah, future's promised. The problem is that to accomplish that, you have to have, you know, like the internet age. When the internet came along, and cell phones especially, eliminated however many apps, you know, and things like that, you have to have job creation outstrip job loss. We're not there anymore. It's job loss is going to be much bigger than job creation with AI and automation. And then we get into something called technological unemployment. But if you don't have the infrastructure ready to support everybody, you don't get to a post-scarcity society. And that's what the book was about. But I did not expect it to happen this fast. And I also did not expect seeing a bunch of, you know, computer programmers putting themselves out of a job by creating a computer program. You know, an AI that can code itself, right? Which they're doing. And you can look at that code and nobody really knows how it works, you know?
At all. Yeah. I sat through the IBM's, the Nice Cat, the newer educator system. IBM gave a talk there. Actually, we were giving a presentation talking about the future of AI and how we need to have students going with AI. You can't teach a child about AI in a past tense. They need to be learning the same time, because when they are ready to deal with AI, the AI is the best AI it can be. You can't. So, and IBM's talking about it, and they're like, we don't unknown what's happening inside the language in there, which was jarring to hear, but oh my God.
It is what it is. It's coming. Then it would take a global effort to slow it down, because if you don't develop it, you know, another country will.
It's already happening. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you don't stop it. The race is going. So
Going, and it's not going to stop. The only thing that stop it is if it doesn't make any money, but it does. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like the robots that were manufacturing cars back in the 80s. Everybody's like, oh, it's taking jobs. it didn't stop us because there was money to be made.
No, and now those robots are a job. They had changed them around. I was like, the pictures of the robots that have been outdated, the new ones have come along. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that's the thing. Like dealing with AI, dealing with anything. I actually have a guest lined up for the show in a month or so, whatever's coming in. But it's actually, they are dealing with the worries of what's going to happen when AI replaces sex work. Because sex work, people don't talk about it, but it's a large portion of the internet. So, and a large portion of the 18 to 25 year old current American women, that is a large portion of money making on just side hustles to make ends meet. Well, AI is now coming for the sex workers, and no one's talking about it. And we don't know what's going to mean. So I have a woman that hopes going to jump on the show talking about it. But that's it. I never read a sci-fi book talking about how it's going to remove cam girls. You know what I mean? That was not it's the shady stuff on the side that no one talks about. It's going to be replaced as well. So,
well, that's the other thing is that, you know, if you're a purveyor of porn, mm-hmm. A perfect, you know, let's call it a specimen, you know, a perfect person. Doing that sex work as an AI that is indistinguishable from a real person, but they're the epitome of perfection.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, for people's proclivities, that's going to make a lot of money. And you're right; it's probably going to cut that market down. And someday, all porn will be. I hate talking about porn because I'm not, you know.
No, just talk about sex work. It's just other careers. I know you're an educator and everything else. It's just the human facets. We're talking about like artists, job, and engineers. We're not talking about the other stuff, like,
no,
too, as well.
Too old to care. been there, done that, as it were. But yeah. But the fact is that it is one aspect, and we shouldn't taboo talking about it because it is something that's, you know, we're already seeing. People that speak to chat bots, you know, and probably have sex talk and all that, committing suicide over it, you know, as though it were a real, you know, love lost or a person or something like that. The lines between reality and fantasy get blurred here.
And human, I mean, that's a trope in movies of the man falling in love with the robot.
It's a very old one. There's a story called Helen Aloy from, 1940s maybe, that was that, you know, that two men had fallen in love with the same robot, and the robot, you know, lost the one that she really loved and wanted to be dissolved in acid, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And it's been so many years since I read
that story,
but for the listener, Helen O apostrophe Loy. And it's a classic sci-fi short story. It's not a long story. But it definitely remains relevant to this day. And that's one of the things I love about reading sci-fi is that a lot of those stories are still relevant, even though they were written, you know, a long time ago. You know, the Dyson Sphere is actually misnamed, and that it was actually concocted by Olaf Stapledon in a book called Star Maker from, I believe, 1938. Other stories, like a really famous one, you know, The Thing. You remember John Carpenter's movie?
Oh yeah.
That story is from 1938, where they're thinking about plant-based life form. That was actually by a guy named John W. Campbell, who was, you know, he was a major sci-fi editor for one of the pulp magazines, and he wrote it under a pseudonym, a pen name. Because it turns out he was a good sci-fi writer himself. But that story, if you read it, is beautiful because it's so descriptive. It starts in an Antarctic station where you smell the dogs, you know, and the human smells and the leather and all of those things, the seal blubber. And he's just so descriptive. And then he gets spookier and spookier as they find that ship and unleash the plant alien. And it's really an amazing story, and it's still good to this day.
That's amazing. Oh my God. I should read that. I actually read there's a, I think it's just a fan made one.
It's called The Thing. It's called Who Goes There?
Who Goes There? Okay. I'm adding to my list. I'm typing it in now. Luckily, I do take suggestions, especially from an author. You've read, I would love to see like what your library or digital library must be. You must be constantly digesting stories and facts and papers and stuff that way as well. So
hundreds of physical books. I have a huge library, and I still like the, you know, I'm stupid. I'm an author. I like used bookstores and going into Barnes and Noble and, you know, the smell of the books and all this stuff. But I also obviously have Kindles and, you know, things like that, and I'll do digital, but I do still love the old school reading environment where you curl up with a book with a, you know, coffee or a martini and make a night of it, you know.
We have there's been some really nice events here that I a friend of mine started doing. They're just like chilling and reading with like a scotch night. It's like on a books. I figure there's a play on words. They have something, but they're drinking like a whiskey and books or something else. But they have like a tasting as you're reading a book. So like every 20 minutes you can go up, they have a different break if you really want to, and you can kind of talk about your book if you want, but then go back down and sit. I can only imagine how, like, so yeah, sitting reading, enjoying a good drink sounds pretty magical right now. It's one of those things that help me, like at night I realize I need to get back into reading books, because when I fall asleep, I dream better after reading a book, after not just like watching or scrolling on the phone or something else, actually conjuring the stuff in my head. I fall asleep with a book on my chest. I'm just kind of out dreaming about magical things. So do you have like that'd be the number one book, but a top sci-fi book or a book that you, your favorite?
Well, first of all, let me tell you a silly story. Yes. The author that wrote the James Bond books, Ian
Fleming. Yeah,
he used to actually put mixed drinks recipes in, because he was a mixologist.
Yeah,
books, and that's where you know. Let me see if I can remember it. Three parts Gordon, one part vermouth, shaken not stirred, came from.
Nice.
my favorite book and sci-fi movie, it's a dual one, is 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Really?
Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke. I think that one is the one that is my favorite, but especially the book. The book is better.
I've been told that. Rochester has the George Eastman Museum. George Eastman did all the film, everything else. So they had a showing of 2001 and Space Odyssey, and I had it, and I watched it over a course of like, everyone had seen it at someone's house. I'd never sat and watched it in its entirety, I realized at one point. Like, I'd just always been on, you know, I own it. You know, it's one of those things that it can be on the background. I'm always happy to see. So I'm like, you know what? So they had a showing of 2001 Space Odyssey, and the actor who plays Dave, he actually was there. He's going to give a talk afterwards. So I watched that movie. And of course I was doing photography for the event. So I had a spot. The last seat that is open was the very front seat, and there's a theater and a stage in front of it. So in that movie, I watched the movie in entirety. You know, and how it ends, it's all swirling around. All of a sudden, a space baby pops up. You know, he goes from old to space baby. Then the credits roll, and Dave walks out as an old guy and sits 4 feet in front of me and starts talking about it. And he's like staring at me. I'm like 4 feet away from him. And I'm like, I don't think Kubrick had this as the understanding of how a man should experience his movie. You know, I'm sorry, Dave. You know, like coming walking out on stage 4 feet in front of me. So. But yeah, so he was talking about it. He goes, I love the thing. And he was even saying, he's like, the book's phenomenal. Because that came up in the questionnaire. Even the actors, like, the book, if you really want to get into it, appreciate the book. So it's on my list. So
yeah, it was essentially what happened with that was that Kubrick contacted Clark, and Kubrick lived in New York at the time. He hadn't yet moved to England, where he was famously living. Mm-hmm. But this was before that. And they stayed where Kubrick was living, which is a famous hotel-apartment in New York City. I can't think of the name off the top of my head. It's very famous for hippies. Bob Dylan lived there.
I know they weren't talking about it. I can't think of the name, but I know it's in, you know, something. it's notable in history. Yeah. It's
notable in history, and it's still there. But Clark moved in there, and over the course of a month, they wrote the screenplay. And Clark also collaborated to a degree with Kubrick. And so the movie and the screenplay was supposed to be credited to Stanley Kubrick, obviously a director, but the screenplay was Kubrick and Clark, but the book was supposed to be Clark and Kubrick. And they co-wrote them at the time, but the publisher apparently decided that it just needs to be Arthur Clark, because Arthur C. Clarke was, you know, very famous. I would have put Stanley Kubrick on there though, because he's now very famous.
Yeah, totally.
But anyway, that's how that happened. I wish I could remember the name of that hotel. Chelsea Hotel.
Chelsea, that was it. At the same time, like Clark said, yeah, Chelsea.
Yeah, it's a neat building. Very neat.
Hey, this is Wade Reed with the Level Up Podcast. How do you take your coffee? What's your favorite espresso drink? Do you prefer wash process or natural process coffees? If any of these questions interest you, tune into the Level Up Podcast presented by Nominate Meals on the Lunchador Podcast Network. We're looking at every link in the coffee supply chain from growing and processing to cafe life and home coffee brewing to find the topics that will enrich and maybe even stretch your experience of coffee. So have a listen, check us out on Instagram and Substack, and as always, enjoy your coffee.
So you asked me if I think that the U.S. government has recovered an alien body or alien technology.
Yeah, we have a bunch of questions came in from the readers from the UAP topic. So, yeah, let's go back. Sure, Roswell, what's going like?
We can ram right into that one.
Yes.
So I don't know, but I have questions. For example, why do they always seem to crash on federally owned land in the U.S. for those cases, right? I know that I understand there are cases in other countries, but in the U.S., they always seem to crash on federal land. Mm-hmm. Because if it crashed in you know, Joe's backyard, which it should by all rights, you know, because most of the country's private property, mm-hmm. or Walmart's parking lot or something like that. Why don't we see that? Why is it always in places like the Nevada test site? Now, I understand those are huge amounts of land, but
still,
there are federal laws, you know, regarding you would have to eminent domain it. You could send in the army and strong arm people, but we really should see this stuff appearing in public places, right? And we also should see it in the archaeological record. In other words, we should find Teflon or plastic in the archaeological sites, and we really don't. Or aluminum, you know, find us an aluminum, you know, Pepsi can from an alien.
And you've seen some of those out-of-time objects.
Yeah, right? I am aware, but the problem is that I was able to find a problem with every one of them.
Same. I got one sent to me from a reader a little bit ago, like the aluminum one. I sent him a picture back of being the tooth from the
excavator. Yeah, that was
excavator. Cool. Yeah, because yeah. I knew what it was. I showed it to me. I'm like, I've replaced those. Grew up on a farm. We had a buck. I know exactly what it was. It was
even worse than that, because that thing, I can't remember the actual name of the object. But the thing is that not only is it aluminum, it's 2000 duralumin, which is an alloy, which is identical to what Romanian coal extraction buckets were for, you did, because it doesn't spark. Mm-hmm. Well, they would, you know, surplus those, and construction companies bought it. And that's where they found the two, fossil skeletons that they were actually removing, and it dropped a tooth, which was riveted on. You can see the hole. So it just was not a good, you know, indicator of some old technology. So one would have to conclude that these UFOs crashing everywhere in the 40s and onward is started recently. Well, you could make the case that, okay, well, we got the aliens' attention, or, you know, they decided to start discarding stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And it has to be said on the other side of it that the only civilization that we've ever seen crash a flying saucer into another planet is us. Are the back shells from the rovers. Mm-hmm. So, and they were just discarded. Rovers worked. Yeah. Well, how do you know that if you got a crash, how do you know it wasn't discarded? You know,
and I never thought of that. That's amazing. Yeah. That was designed to crash the thing. Yeah. The rover walked off. So that's out there thank you for adding a layer to that concern in my
head. Yeah, there's a layer for you there. I put a lot of thought into this for the people asking the UFO questions. However, I don't preclude it. Because what do I know? You know? And I just did an interview with the acting director of Arrow, former acting director. And before that, I did with the director, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick. Mm-hmm. And they found a manual in somewhere in the government that said, here's how you recover a UFO and how you package it up, you know. And it turned out, which is the infamous Majestic 12 documents, it turned out that they found that as an onion skin bound somewhere in the government. They haven't told me where they found it.
Yeah, yeah, but it was clearly in the system. It was just clearly on a shelf somewhere. Yeah,
clearly in the system, and it was a credible document that fit the typefaces of the time. And it was apparently an original Onion Skin copy, which is not out there. All we have is pictures and photocopies. Well, where'd that come from? But you have to ask the question, could we have faked that in order to send the Russians on a wild goose chase? Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds of questions. The unfortunate thing is that it's hopelessly mired in multiple ways. You know, even to the point that maybe the government was faking its own documents and putting them out there. And well, that makes it an official fake, you know. So when you're dealing with that, I haven't been able to get a real answer. So I don't believe in it. I'm just open to it because, you know, I'd look really stupid if I said, well, I've been pontificating on YouTube for 10 years about aliens and alien civilizations and the Fermi paradox, if I didn't look, you know, properly at the UFO thing just to see if there's something there.
Yeah.
But I'm left perplexed. You know, there's weird stuff like the Nimitz case. I don't know what they saw, you know.
Yeah, there's been a handful of cases that, like, my ex-girlfriend at one point put it out. She was like, it'd be cool if is my how I wanted my life to be. Like, it'd be cool if it was thinking like, and I'm agnostic on most things. I don't even use, like, I'm not like atheistic. I don't think that's a term I like using. I'm agnostic. I question a lot. I'm curious on it, and I want the truth on the matter. But I also, I have like 5 to 10% wonder in my life, because it'd be cool if. So I definitely ask those questions. I wanted to get to it. Nothing's off the table because I'm generally curious on it. And I think that'd be a wonderful story if, but
the thing is that if somebody comes to me and they say, I saw something weird in the sky, mm-hmm. I believe them, you know. My initial instinct is, yeah, you saw something you couldn't identify, which is an unidentified flying object. Mm-hmm. So I keep an open mind there. I'm not like this hyper skeptic. I just will take a look at what everybody's got. And my evidence bar has not been met yet. But my interest bar is, it's like, mm-hmm. what the heck's going on here, right? But that people see things that they can't explain, some of which will remain anomalous forever because the government sees things it can't explain, mm-hmm. Like the Nimitz event, you know? So, I'm open to it. I just apply scientific skepticism, but not hyper skepticism. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not a debunker or anything like that. And that's how I deal with it. That's how I take it, is open mind, you know, reasonable skepticism, so that we know what the hell it is, you know, that we know it's real, you know, that we're not following a wild goose chase or a story. But I do not have a resolution for the UFO UAP phenomenon. I don't know what it is. I do think, though, that I would expect aliens to behave differently than what's described.
Interesting. So you do believe, let's just start like kind of a back up to the thing. You believe life exists in the universe, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's, I don't think it's possible for us to be alone.
Now, and this is a choose your adventure. The next step in that question, do you believe there's, I'll actually jump back to the topic at some point too, but so there's intelligent life in the universe as well, not just us out there. There's other ones looking up, right?
I do not believe I'm unique. You know, I do not believe as a civilization we are unique, because we are a sampling of one, but that suggests, you know, that there's others out there, maybe not existing at the same time. There are all kinds of qualifications, caveats. But the thing is I do not think, since we're here, I am not comfortable calling myself a unicorn, you know, that where magical chemistry happens only on this world, which is like the island from Lost. And it suddenly, even though life got started here, is impossibly rare as some claim it is, it still resulted in intelligence. I don't buy it. I think that the universe is teeming with all sorts of life, and some of it will be intelligent, but I do suspect a lot of it is microbial.
Yeah, I feel I talk about that. I think as we travel, if we ever get a chance to travel and go to every planet, we're going to go to a lot of planet with just slime mold. This will just be like back. There's like an ocean of green, just algae as far as the eye can see. A lot of millions of years and billions of years of just very microbial stuff happening, I'm guessing.
You have no idea how beautiful that would be, though. I would absolutely love the sludge, because that, if you find me one microbe that's genetically completely distinct from a different origin at Europa, in the ocean at Europa or on Mars, my question is answered, in that life on Earth is not alone. I'm happy with that. You know, if one thing can happen in my life, they find a microbe, then I'm happy. Because I think that intelligent life, while I think it exists out there somewhere, I think it's going to be hard to find, you know. And I think it's probably rare, you know, because most species on Earth didn't, you know, build computers, only us. So I tend to think rarity is probably what's going on there. But not uniqueness. I don't like uniqueness, because the entire universe, you know, everything we see is repeatable. You know, you see an asteroid, well, you're probably going to see another asteroid. You know, you see a star do something, you're probably going to see another one.
Yeah, there's very few case examples of one in that thing. Now, what happens if we, so you go in Europa and they come, pops out and it looks like something that is from Earth. Like, what's the, if life is out there, but so far the life we find is similar to what we see here, what is your take on that?
Well, there's a couple of ways that happens. You need to look at the genetics, because if you look at the genetics of life on Earth, everything is related, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be. The DNA molecule can, you know, do all kinds of things. So you look at the genetics, but we have something called convergent evolution, where, you know, a shark and a dolphin are similarly shaped because their form works best.
Yeah.
So far, I mean, a shark is a fish and a dolphin is a mammal. There's a huge gulf there, but they end up similar.
You know? Yeah. The pattern works. It's the most efficient form to move through. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So you're going to see convergent evolution probably. But sometimes you can't apply that or predict it, because, you know, you could say, like Star Trek, you know, oh, the aliens are going to look like us. Well, but the problem is we evolved specifically from a fish that had four fins. That's the only reason we have, you know, four limbs. So you won't see convergences there, but you will see convergences where it just simply makes the most sense, you know, and evolution will drive that into convergent evolution. And you can apply that also to thinking and brains. If you watch an octopus, right, and you watch what it does, you understand what it's doing. You know, it's like that octopus is trying to eat that, you know, clam. You know what it's thinking and what it's doing. So I think intelligence will evolve the same way. And sometimes there's no other way it could, and that would be technology. Because you want to do radio astronomy, you have to build a radio telescope, which is governed by physical laws, you know, parabolic dish and all that. Aliens would know that. So that's the whole concept behind SETI, is that they would, as a technological species, be constrained by the physics of our technology. And that's where that sits, you know, so they look for that. But so far, nothing good yet. I stress, nothing good yet. There are things hidden in science, though, in astronomy, that are pretty weird.
Nice. Oh, man. So there is a theory. So when you're looking at early life on planet Earth, we have amoebic life that is looked relatively simplistic, but the DNA is extremely complex, like a shockingly advanced RNA and DNA system was already kind of pre-installed, it seems like, inside the amoebic, just the nature of the creature, grow, you know, anything else. For shockingly early on, I mean, it started that way. Do you feel that life is like a panspermia life, that the reason that the amoeba has such a diverse DNA set to pull from is that it spawned from something before the planet existed? Like, is there a, like, as the I think it was Kirk Kasag did the show episode where there's life itself is needs a certain set to live in, right? Temperature, the nutrients, just the medium to move through, and that sort of stuff. And the early
early solar system, or not solar system, the early universe itself, as from the Big Bang forward, there's a point where everything is warm, everything is the right temperature. They had theorized that maybe life started then, so it had billions of years to build these DNA structures, RNA complexes, proteins, handling that sort of stuff. In their instance, they have life starts so far on from the moment when like the universe gets going, it starts going on. Do you believe that there's a panspermic idea that way, that life started elsewhere? Or do you think that the life that we see on this planet are started here, kicked off here on this rock?
If it started on this rock, it happened the very first moment it possibly could, almost even before, you know, you start seeing evidence of life and they keep pushing the date back, and it's getting into the late heavy bombardment and it's getting hard to believe that life could arise here through abiogenesis. But at the same time, Mars looks pretty good, for its period. It's better than Earth. So maybe panspermic, life transfer happened and that we're actually from Mars for all we know. But the sun was also still in its birth cluster, so it could have happened in another star system. But how far does that chain go? And that's where that idea is when was the very first period in which, it was habitable. And there are two ideas on that. There was actually, a universe-wide habitable zone where liquid water was possible not long after the Big Bang, where, it was expanding and it was warm enough for everywhere. But could you have had planets? And that's, not really. But once you get to habitability in the universe as we know it with planets, that's 8 billion or more years ago, where planets became very common, probably significantly before, because all you need is supernovas, and it could be conditional before then. There were less planets, but it still happens. And can that be transferred through star systems? Absolutely. The sun will have close encounters and always has had close encounters because stars all have different proper motion in the Milky Way, and it passes near stars and then they pass away. Well, one of them happened not that long ago, tens of thousands of years. It's called Schultz's star, and it passed within a light year. Well, that's easily enough to where the two Oort clouds of both systems could intermix and meteorites can be exchanged and life, maybe we seeded life there. So we don't know. All we know is that the resiliency of the microbes is such that it appears they can, hold on as spores, in meteorites and transfer. So if we go to Europa and we start finding E. coli, something like that, then, there's your question answered, right? And you could actually tell the progenitors genetically. So, what body did it originate from? I think that would blow people's minds if life started on Mars or Europa and got deposited here, and that this is not our home world.
I would love to have something magic. So that'd be an amazing thing. Before you get put into your giant pyramid, we're going to get some sort of cellular understanding. So there's an alien out there. There's some sort of life happening elsewhere on these worlds out there. Sure. So what is some of the examples? I mean, you've had so many amazing videos talking about like techno signatures, things about the universe, the aliens, everything else. I'm a creature guy. I love creature design. I love aliens. I love sci-fi movies. I love when you can just like, I'm not a huge Star Wars guy, but if you give me the Star Wars book on all the ecosystems, all the planets, I'll look at those all day long, So in your head, you're a sci-fi author too. Do you envision planets? Do you like put scenarios together? But like, what is in your head when looking at the stars, are you seeing the what if planets? I would love to hear what your sci-fi head thinks of when you stare up at the sky.
I'm working on a new book and it incorporates this. My previous books were basically humans in space or humans in the future, but now I'm doing aliens. And my thinking is this, what would an alien civilization that's incomprehensible look like, which is what Arthur Clarke was going with the space baby, You know, you're not supposed to understand what that was.
Yeah.
Well, my thinking is that, you know, an alien civilization may simply be a cloud bank on an exoplanet that shouldn't be habitable, you know, through uploading through nanotechnology, right? So you're just you're fog, you know, and you will never see that, you know, you will never see that from a distance. It's a cloud on an exoplanet, you know. So that's where my thinking is, you know, and what if that planet reconfigures itself through the nanotechnology? One day it has mountains and oceans, the next day it doesn't, you know, which you can't do overnight, but
but
it's that sort of stuff where, you know, planet changes. And one of my videos from quite a while ago, it was called The Impossible Planet, where I was like, well, what happens if you see a planet like Mars? You know, say you're outside of the solar system, you're light years distant, and you see a terraformed Mars. You know how big it is. You know it shouldn't be able to hold on to an atmosphere, yet it has one. So you can infer, since it's right next to a planet that's habitable, you know, very obviously so, you can infer that aliens are active there and that that planet has been terraformed. And if you start seeing it in surrounding star systems, you know, you're seeing terraformers. And that's what we call a technosignature, you know, and there are many of those, but it's one where you start seeing clustered planets that are unnaturally habitable. You're seeing something, and we're getting now with the James Webb Space Telescope into the territory, the very beginning of the territory, where we can start to characterize exoplanets and ask ourselves, you know, is that what we're seeing? You know, we're seeing too many habitable planets here.
Yeah, because we have so many different, seems like habitable. What's the one that made the news here? Was the K2-18b, right? That's one that's making the rounds now?
Yeah, and it has a gas profile, which is actually double weird because it has a lot of methane, more than really should have. It isn't mentioned much in the media. And it also shows a biogenic gas, a gas that's usually created by biology, but we don't know for sure that it can't be produced another way.
Is this the same idea, like, for lack of a better term, like how we're surprised by dark oxygen, like the whole, like, the something else, like we didn't expect that, so it's same along the same lines?
It's along the same lines. Maybe we don't know that there is a you know, a natural mechanism to produce this, but that you're seeing at a distance, you know, is significant. That's a lot of gas if you can see it that far away. Even though, you know, K2-18b is relatively close, it's still, space is vast, right? And, you know, things get lost in the noise. That is if that detection is on solid ground. We don't know. They make a case that it's a 3 sigma detection, which is kind of a rating system for how confident you are. It needs to be about 5. So it's an open question. So K2-18b is an open story that will continue to evolve for several years. But that's the fun part, you know.
Now, are there other planets? I mean, you are much more versed in what's going on there. Are there other examples that you're kind of have your telescope towards, thinking maybe another sign of stuff? Is there other ones that stand out to you?
There's a much worse one.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm all ears. Tell us. Scare us away, man.
So there is a star called Chbilisky Star. And it's showing, according to one study, it's showing... Actually, several studies showed that this star has a very weird makeup as far as the metals it contains, right? Antoni Chbilisky, the Polish-Australian astronomer that first studied it, you know, in the 60s, noticed that it had very, very low iron, unusually low iron for this kind of star. But then a group of Russian astronomers several years ago went and looked at it, and they started seeing weird spikes and the spectroscopy, you know, the makeup of the light absorbing, and it's consistent with transuranic elements like plutonium,
something that has a half-life that is way too short to be in a star kind of idea, right?
It's got all sorts of stuff. It also has a very strong signature of a element called technetium that is very difficult to arrive at. It's not transuranic, it's in the periodic table. Very difficult to arrive at that without some really weird nuclear hanky-panky and decay going on. But cast your mind back to 1967, And when Carl Sagan, the famous Carl Sagan, and a Soviet scientist, Shklovsky, suggested that when you start seeing elements that are very hard or don't occur at all in nature, you might be seeing a technosignature. And that starts with plutonium, because in a uranium deposit, you'll get a few atoms of plutonium, but to see an amount of it enough in a star that you could detect, that's a lot of plutonium. So that star, you know, they suggested that aliens might salt their star with these elements that don't occur in nature in order to say, you know, here we are.
I'm actually super glad you brought that up. I had a whole episode I did specifically on that star. Now I get to ask you this question. You're a sci-fi author. What's the story going on? You know, doesn't be right or wrong, but what's the sci-fi story happening in the JMG's brain right now of what's happening at that star?
You really want to know?
Of course I do. My God. I'll drink with you again. We'll get some more drinks. Keep the conversation going. I want it. Because I have a... My story, I actually did a whole episode with what my thought is in a very, like, the facts about it, what's happening. And I'll put a link in the show notes for those who want to go back to that old episode as well. But it was what was happening with it, what the science was saying. And then I also did what my creative brain hopes is happening, what the story is. So what is your story about this? And remind me the name of the star again, just so everyone knows.
Jabilski star, which is, it's spelled, it's Polish. It's
okay. Yeah.
You can spell it. You know, put you know. Anyway, the star to me says we have extremely advanced nuclear physics, and we can salt our star with enormous amounts of transuranic elements. Stay away.
Interesting. So it's a warning beacon of like what the power we have. We can mass produce this, so you don't. It's like telling people we have nukes for like on America, like. Come at us. We got the biggest weapons possible. As you're saying, that's what the star is more of a showing of power. That's amazing.
Yeah, but who are they afraid of?
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's my next question. Jeez. I love a good sci-fi author. Oh, they make me so happy to. Mine was a little bit. So my theory was a little bit more of a romantic that I was thinking that we found our first lighthouse star that. In the sea of the universe, if you knew the makeup of a star, like if we can put in, you know, a certain set chemical in a star being broadcast out, if you're lost in space, you scan around, you're like, oh, this star is giving off these frequencies. So in my head, there is a lonely, like actually in my drawing, I have a couple of sketches. I should send it to you, but you're the person who probably appreciate this. I did a sketch of like this, like cephalopod looking alien who just loves living alone. It's not a species that like wants company, and his whole job is just see like the aliens just drop off the chemical process. So he's got all day long. He just puts in these chemicals to make sure the lighthouse is fed. And there's another one we haven't seen it yet. Like from Earth's standpoint, there's a star we haven't found yet that is the other lighthouse that has a different makeup. And that was my theory and my story. I thought in my head a little more of a hopeful lighthouse in the sky versus you make me now nervous that they're trying to scare off something else. Oh,
yes. What lurks out there?
Yeah,
can't see, and maybe this civilization slipped through, where you have the first civilization, let's say, of the Milky Way galaxy that arose 8 billion years ago, and it decides I can have no threats, which would explain the Great Silence, right?
You're right.
I can have no threats, so I put down anything that I find that is getting close to technology, you know, that I don't like, and I put it down, you know, but it missed one. And they decided to just turn the star into a warning that we passed that. What's scary, though, is artificial intelligence, maybe that line, that might be the great filter. Because if you're an alien civilization and the humans are creating an artificial intelligence that's going to destroy them and head out into space and menace the galaxy, why wouldn't you stop that before it became a problem?
I love a good sci-fi author. Their brains makes me happy to see. Jeez.
And I think we're going to call it quits for the time being here. This is going to be a part one of a part two episode. So I want to thank John Michael Gaudier for jumping on the microphone. We'll be talking more with him for part two. So tune in next week for the continuing adventures and listening to the man talk. We're going to be jumping on with questions from you wonderful listeners that have sent in some sci-fi facts and questions you want to know about. So if you want to follow John Michael Gaudier's stuff, go to YouTube, do a search. His name and all information will be in the show notes here. His show, The Event Horizon, is every Thursday on YouTube. Go check it out. They bring on guests that are power hitters in the world of science, science journalism, science fiction. And as we heard, we also had Werner Herzog on there as well. So definitely worth a check out. Add it to your subscription list. You will love having this pop up in your feeds. And there'll be more of this wonderful interview next week. So tune in. And I want to thank everyone who's been messaging, saying hi, and following me and supporting me on Patreon. So if you guys want to do that as well, feel free to do so. Just go to MagnusApollo.com. You can follow all the links that way. There also is a link tree sharing all my fun little ways of getting hold of me, following me, asking questions, sending your stories in, or letting me know what guests I should have on this show. It wouldn't be anything without you guys. So thanks so much for following. And Matt will take us on out from here.
Do you have a crazy story, odd factoid, or want to share something you think will help expand the mind of Magnus? Let us know! Call our voicemail, 585-310-2473, visit mindofmagnus.com, or message us on social media at Magnus Apollo.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Pauly Guglielmo, host of the Pauly Guglielmo Show here on the Lunchador Podcast Network and founder of Guglielmo Sauce, owner of Craft Cannery, bottling many of your favorite local and regional sauces, dressings, and marinades. You can find Guglielmo's at any area Wegmans or at many local mom and pops around the city.